Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Today is Wednesday, 22 July, 2026 years after Jesus. And we're back in Mirabelli versus Olson. We're going to finish this today. We've been working on it since December. It's now styled as Mirabelli versus Bonta, but it wasn't originally. If you go to the Thomas More Society, you can look up this case. And I'm scrolling down. I'm on the Thomas More Society right now. Scrolly little Wally down to December 22nd, 2025 order granting summary judgment in favor of plaintiffs, and click on that. That's what I have pulled up right here, and you can see it's Mirabelli versus Mark Olson. And we stopped last time on page 38, and so we're going to just go ahead and scroll down to page 38. We stopped last time on line 11. Number three, not interests of the highest order. And we're going to continue on today. And my goal is to finish this today, which we should be able to do. If you have any questions, leave them in the comments. But otherwise, I would say, just go back and look where we left off last time. And you want to listen to the last few minutes of that if you can. And that will get you up to speed. It's all like, it's kind of like when you go to class, you should look at your notes from last time before you go to class. That's why I have pop quizzes in the beginning of my classes, 5-10 minutes, big ticket items from the last time, from the reading or whatever that we discussed, because I want to encourage students to get in there and review their notes before class, so that class time is used most productively. So that's what we're going to do today. We're also going to have, at the end of the episode, a Chaplain's Corner, which is a segment that I feature on the end of some of the episodes. And it's a Chaplain's Corner, which is to center our minds on the things that matter most, on spiritual things. We're going through some of the Psalms, and we're going through a book called Streams in the Desert, which is originally published in 1925, non-woke edition, Kalman Publications, Las Vegas Station, Los Angeles, California. And we're on February 2nd today, so we'll do that at the end of the episode. Okay, so let's get to this, shall we? I'm going to share my screen. Feel free to call me, you guessed it, Bob. Just kidding. Call me Sharon, because I'm sharing my screen. Okay. Not interests of the highest order. Mirabelli versus Olson, 22 December 2025. This is Judge Roger Benitez, who just retired. Excellent guy on the Second Amendment as well. Of course, you know that this has to do with the so-called transgenderism craze, which got so people crazy in the K-12 in California that they had this policy of lying to parents. Lying. Lying. To cover up fraud. To continue a fraud. And to hurt students and families. Now, I'm not saying that's what they had in mind, but you know what? Somebody had it in mind. Might have not been the parents, might not have been the school administrators, but we do have principalities and powers in high places that don't have the best interests in mind. And that's what we believe as Christians. So we fight not against flesh and blood. But you know what? This guy is all over this. Roger Benitez. Line 12, page 38. For the state defendants, that would be California Democrats, For the state dependence policies to survive strict scrutiny, they must first advance an interest of the highest order. So here we go with scrutiny land here, what Judge Van Dyke calls, well, actually, who called it scrutiny land? I can't remember. I think it was Randy Barnett called it that in a law review article. I don't know if he came up with that title or not, but it's a great title. The state defendants, Democrat California, identify a general interest in providing a, quote, safe, unquote, learning environment, but the interest is too broadly stated. Overly broad formulations of compelling government interests are insufficient. They describe, and I know I'm not quoting every quote, and I'm not going to do every citation because there's a lot in parentheses, and I just skip over those. You can take a look at those. There's also footnotes. We get to some of those. So I'm skipping over parenthetical quotations in general. Okay. Now, they describe, Roger Benitez continues, judge, a federal judge in California who just retired. They describe an interest in safeguarding a minor school student's individual's privacy. Their reasoning here, however, is something of a tautology when they say, quote, California maintains a strong interest in safeguarding the individual's privacy precisely because there is no compelling safety rationale for overriding that constitutional right. Okay. Now, let me look at footnote 12. Okay. I'm going to skip footnote 12. More importantly, we're on page 39. In articulating their interest in state defendants, their interest, the state defendants completely ignore the fact that parents of students possess a free exercise right to direct a child's religious teaching. The most articulate statement of the government's interest is found at page 25 of its brief. Quote, the state has a legitimate and even compelling interest in protecting transgender and gender nonconforming students from bullying and harassment, and in fostering a safe and supportive school environment where students can learn without fear of being outed to their parents before they are ready. This includes an interest in protecting these students from the harms, such as a heightened risk of suicide, that can result when school staff, quote, forcibly out, unquote, within the quote, students without their consent and before they are ready, unquote. So that was the California Democrat brief at page 25. The weakness of this articulation of the government interest is that the notion of a learning environment where students are insulated from their parents' discovery of a non-conforming gender identity is somehow better for a child is yet to be proven. Ironically, it is often other student peers and school staff that are not supportive, according to state defendants expert Al Shama. Okay, there's supporting quotation there. The state defendants also identify what they describe as, quote, a compelling government interest in protecting students' privacy as to their bodily autonomy, even with respect to their parents, unquote. Yet, the state defendants do not offer to explain how the stated government interest is furthered by, page 40 at the top, their parental exclusion policies. The policies address gender identity rather than bodily autonomy. Oops. Oops. There's the impact of grade inflation on these Democrats here in California. Certainly, the state defendants have a compelling interest in providing a safe learning environment. It is a legitimate purpose for schools to try to protect students with safety and well-being. and even to try to eliminate discrimination on the basis of sex or transgender status. For example, in approving a prohibition on child pornography, the Supreme Court noted that, quote, it is evident beyond the need for elaboration that a state's interest in safeguarding the physical and psychological well-being of a minor is compelling, unquote. Yeah, that's a good quotation. Nevertheless, the state defendants have not made the case that non-disclosure of a child's gender identity to the child's parents is a state interest of the highest order. Nor is there binding precedent. The medical experts agree that parental support is necessary for the best outcomes, and constitutional principles rest on the premise that parents attempt to act in the best interests of their child. Well, yeah, I mean, these dadgum Democrats are trying to take kids away from their parents. It's supposed to be in loco parentis, not parentis. And I know that's bad grammar for Latin, but you get the point. A little water on these warm days. Not to bring up health food, but let us continue. Number four, not narrowly tailored. Even assuming, Judge Benitez continues, line 18, page 40, Mirabella versus Olson, 22 December 2025, years after Jesus. Even assuming, for the sake of argument, that the state defendants identified an interest of the highest order in the form of the parental exclusion policies, the policies remain constitutionally defective because they are not narrowly tailored. The state defendants concede that parents, quote, may find notification that their child is expressing transgender identity at school helpful in the general exercise of their right to direct a religious upbringing for their child, unquote. So, the state defendants are aware that notification would be helpful to religious parents, but provide no room for those parents to exercise those federal constitutional rights. Are you getting this? Just like in the case in Mahmood, which was a Supreme Court decision last year, the California state education parental exclusion policies provide no exceptions for religious parents. That's a shocker. Page 41 at the top, number five, tailoring twice declined. At the hearing, the court proposed two methods to more narrowly tailor the gender parental exclusion policies. The first method is currently in use in Escondido Union School District as a result of this court's preliminary injunction. There, if a child wants to use a different name or pronouns, the school says, quote, we understand, unquote, but explains that it will have to talk to the parents, the child's parents. If the child objects to informing his or her parents, then the school responds that it cannot respect the request. When asked if the state policies could offer that form of tailoring, the Deputy Attorney General for Democrat California, and I said Democrat California, Roger Benitez did not say that, but that's what's true, so I'm putting it in there. The Deputy Attorney General representing the state defendants declined to take a position. Now, page 11, line 11, page 41. The second method of tailoring this court proposed is an annual school district questionnaire. The questionnaire would inform, excuse me, the questionnaire would ask parents if they want to be informed in the event their child is observed to be experiencing gender incongruity or asking to go by a new name. If the parents said yes, then the school would inform the parents during the year. If the parents said no, then the school would not inform the parents during the year. The Deputy Attorney General suggested such a policy would violate privacy protection for students. Wow. In other words, the state defendants' transgender secrecy policies, okay, found another typo, Found another typo, guys. Can you see it on the page? Can you see it on the page? Another missing apostrophe, a possessive apostrophe. You see, state defendants should be apostrophe right there after the S. The state defendants' gender secrecy policies do not attempt in any way to tailor policies so as to respect the free exercise rights of parents. They do not provide for an opt-out from school recognition and propaganda of gender incongruent names. Oh, whoa, excuse me. They do not provide an opt-out form. They do not provide an opt-out from school recognition and propagation of gender incongruent names. I said propaganda, which is actually not a bad little substitution, but so they do not provide for an opt-out from school recognition and propagation of gender incongruent names. They do not provide notice to parents who need or ask for notice. They do not even acknowledge a parent's constitutional right to direct their child's religious upbringing. Mahmud rejected such a vision of the power of the state to strip away the critical right of parents to guide the religious development of their children, calling it chilling. That's Mahmud at 145 in the Supreme Court Reporter at page 2358, which you can find on Google Scholar. The state defendants have articulated an overly broad state interest. The state defendants have not demonstrated a narrowly tailored policy. A blanket prohibition on accurate communications in all instances with all parents regarding all public school students does not fit the notion of narrow tailoring. As such, the state defendants' parental exclusion policies fail the narrow tailoring prong of the strict scrutiny test. So they're getting nailed there in scrutiny land. Page 42 at the top, in the end, line three there. The plaintiff class of parents face an unlawful choice along the lines of, quote, lose your faith and keep your child in public school, or keep your faith but lose public schooling. Quote, respect for religious expressions is indispensable to life in a free and diverse republic. That's quoting Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, and that's in the 597th volume of the U.S. reports at page, starting at page 507, but it's actually quoting 543, 2022. We covered that on the podcast. You know what? Maybe I should link it. Now, the only meaningful justification of the state defendants, the only meaningful justification the state defendants offer for their insistence that the plaintiffs have no choice in the matter about their own children rests on a mistaken view that the state defendants bear a duty to place a child's right to privacy above and in derogation of the right of a child's parents, the rights of a child's parents. The Supremacy Clause of the Federal Constitution does not sanction that kind of rights, it misbalancing imposed by a state. The plaintiffs have proven the merits of their free exercise claim as a matter of law. Because there are no genuine issues of material fact, they are entitled to judgment as a matter of law and a permanent injunction. Page 42, line 18, letter C, C as in boy. Just kidding. C as in zoo. Just kidding again. I know. C as in cat. I'm serious now. Okay. C as in cat. Teachers' First Amendment free exercise rights claims 2 and 3. The subclass of public school teachers seek a declaration. Now we're on the teachers. So we were on the parents' constitutional rights. Now we're on the teachers because their rights were violated by Democrat California too. The subclass of public school teachers seek a declaration that the state parental exclusion policies violate their own First Amendment rights to the free exercise of religion. Oh my gosh, you cannot make this up, guys. You cannot make up that this was a frickin' controversial issue in politics in California for the last couple of years. You just cannot believe it. It's unbelievable. Freedom of religion, not to lie. I mean, that's how basic we've gotten here. Why can't you obey the lying policies? Because, violates my religion. Oh man. Jeez, you would think that that would just be common sense morality, but no, they. Okay, the teachers seek to enjoin the state policies would prevent them from communicating accurately with the parents of their gender non-conforming students. By the way, guys, check out the case of Jessica Tapia, 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 Jessica Tapia. Follow her on Instagram. I mean, I do. I was following her right after she got fired, I think. So she talked about it on Instagram. Anyway, you probably already know that. Okay. Now, at the outset of this case, two public school teachers who sincerely hold religious beliefs sought protection for their First Amendment free exercise rights. At that time, the state defendant's parent exclusion policies had been adopted by its local educational agency, the Escondido Union School District. The teacher plaintiffs were severely burdened by the policies that required teachers to deceive, required teachers to deceive parents. Policies that required teachers to deceive parents. That was the Democrat position. The Republican position was no. The teacher plaintiffs were severely burdened by the policies that required teachers to deceive parents concerning gender nonconforming students under their tutelage. The local school district threatened adverse employment action. In that case I mentioned, Jessica Tapia got fired because she would not lie to parents when she was ordered to. She was a gym teacher at Jurupa Valley High School in Riverside County, Southern California. Since then, Judge Benitez continues, two additional public school teachers have joined as plaintiffs, both proceeding under pseudonyms for fear of reprisals at their schools. These teachers also sincerely hold religious beliefs that are severely burdened by being forced to stand mute or deceive the parents about gender non-conforming students in their classrooms. For these teachers, as is likely the case statewide, the local school communicated a no exception stance due to the, there's another typo. No exception stance due to N, and there's just an N there. I don't know what it's doing there. It's just sitting there. Due to N, the mandatory nature of the state defendant's policies. Well, I guess Roger Benitez was so excited to get this sucker out, and maybe he had some more Christmas shopping to do. Recall, this was published on the 22nd of December, 2025. We were so excited we got to it right away, even though we were in Tennessee at the time. Okay, number one, Jane Rowe's story. One teacher, Jane Rowe, says she's a devout Christian. She explains, as a Christian, I believe God made man and woman in his image, specifically male and female. I believe that it is impossible to change our sex and that our sex was given to us by God for a reason. I also believe that we are fearfully and wonderfully made and God doesn't make mistakes. Rowe continues, because of this, I believe it would violate my religious beliefs to mislead a parent about his or her child's gender transition at school. Yeah, and that's assuming that there would be that was even possible to transition gender. But yeah, the attempt, I agree. Continuing the quote, I understand that California requires me and all other school staff to accept a student's statement of their gender identity and immediately begin treating them as a member of the opposite sex, regardless of whether their parents consent or even know. I would add also, regardless of whether it's metaphysically possible. And if the child tells me that he does not want his parents to know about this, then I must keep it from them. As a requirement for employment by the school system, the California school system, this is a severe burden on my religious beliefs. This is not a hypothetical burden, Judge Benitez continues. Continuing the quote of Jane Roe, the teacher, the devout Christian teacher, I had two transgender students in my classes during the 24-25 school year, relates Roe. Additionally, there were two transgender students in my classes during the 2023-24 school year, and a larger cohort of approximately six the year before, 2022 to 2023 school year. This has created a lot of stress for me because I would normally be very open and communicative with their parents, sending instant messages whenever I see something off with their child. Page 44 at the top. Roe declares that it is my understanding that no one has been granted a religious accommodation exempting them from these policies. You need a religious accommodation not to lie. That's where we're at in electoral politics in California between this during Biden. Notice the first year of Trump, bam, the courts got involved and boom, Republican judges put a stop to it. Trump too, I should say, the second term. Wow, it's amazing. So my understanding that no one, Roe says that my understanding that nobody, no one has been granted a religious accommodation exempting them from these policies. Instead, I have witnessed firsthand the retaliation and harassment against my colleague and friend, Elizabeth Mirabelli. Administrators made it clear to me, reports Roe, that I'm not saying quote and unquote the whole time. It's just too clunky, sorry. Administrators made it clear to me, reports Roe, that failing to adhere to the policy would result in termination. Roe has witnessed negative repercussions suffered by others. I am proceeding anonymously in this case to avoid any personal retaliation at work. I understand that Elizabeth Mirabelli and Lori Ann West were on administrative leave for much of 2023 and were both essentially run out of school. Jane Bowes story, number two, line 10, page 44. Plaintiff teacher Jane Bowe, that's B as in boy, seriously, Boe. Plaintiff teacher Jane Bowe, I've never seen that use of a pseudonym before, describes a similar employment experience. She describes herself as a devout Christian. Bowe states, quote, I believe that God made man and woman is image, both male and female. I believe that it is impossible to change our sex and that our sex was given to us by God for a reason. I also believe that scripture teaches that parents have a moral responsibility to guide their children and that children have a moral responsibility to obey their parents. This is a sacred relationship that is immoral for me to interfere with. Unquote. Bo explains, and I'm not going to do that quote and unquote again. So for the longer ones, I will do it, but there's so many quote and unquote that it's just too clunky. Bo explains, I believe it would violate my religious beliefs to deceive parents about their child's gender transition at school. This is where we're at, guys. Lying was an electoral politics issue between Republicans and Democrats in California the last 5 years. Lying to parents. before Republican judges put an end to it. Guys, elections matter. You got to get those Republican judges in there. You have to. Man. And not all of them are good, you know? So that's why it's really important to you know the drill. Come on, you know. Now, when she sought to discuss the burden placed on her with a school administrator, she was rebuked. That is satanic, man. She's Beau recounts, I approached the assistant principal to explain my issues with the policy, that I had sincerely held religious convictions that prevented me from complying. In response, the assistant principal stated, if you're not able to follow this policy, you may have to find a different job. I was shocked and extremely distressed by his comment and perceived it as a threat. According to Beau, little has changed since the entry of the preliminary injunction. Beau says, while I understand that the CDE has removed the legal advisory and FAQ page from their website, I also understand that the CDE continues to assert that they accurately described the law that school districts must follow. Page 45 at the top. I also understand that EUSD has tried to change its policies to come into compliance with this court's understanding of the law, but that the state has taken the position that EUSD's new policies are illegal. So I still fell bound by the training and instruction I received from school leadership and under threat to abide by these policies or, quote, find a different job, unquote, within the quote. California public schools may be gun-free zones, but they are not First Amendment-free zones. Oh, man. Oh, Benitez, I wish you would have taken a rabbit trail down the 2A there, but you're too professional for that. To hold differently would be to treat religious expression as a second-class speech, as second-class speech, and eviscerate this court's repeated promise that teachers do not shed their constitutional rights of freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gate, quoting Kennedy versus Bremerton, 597 U.S. 507 at 531, 2024. And that's quoting Tinker, 393 U.S. at 506. Now, four teacher plaintiffs and class representatives sincerely hold religious beliefs that are being severely burdened by the imposition of the parental exclusion policies. You know, I have to say, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I'm going to say it again. This language of sincerely held religious beliefs, I can't get too much into it today, but the court has made a mess of the religion clause jurisprudence, I think, the last 100 years. I can't get into that today, but I also don't want to give you the impression that the subject matter is somehow easy, because it's not. The subject matter is not easy. It's inherently difficult what the founders and framers of the Constitution tried to do in putting those religion clauses in there. You got the free exercise clause, you've got the establishment clause, and they go right next to each other, and somehow they're supposed to be consistent with each other and produce consistent results. And this is not a time to get into whether that's possible or not. Let's just say that it's a very high bar, and the court has often failed at enforcing those provisions correctly. Now, I made mention of this phrase, sincerely hold religious beliefs or sincerely held religious beliefs. This lawyer talk, because nobody, I mean, come on, sincerely held religious beliefs. I think of those people that don't consider themselves religious. Maybe they're atheists, maybe they're agnostics, and they're sincere in their atheism and agnosticism, or agnosticism. And I think, what about them? Can they have a constitutional right to object to these policies? I mean, there's something about this that bothers me, that we try to stuff everything in the religion clauses because it legally is very powerful. And it's legally very powerful because of the way the religion clauses are framed and how they've been interpreted. But sometimes I just step back and I wonder, are we crazy or something? I mean, what about just common sense? There's no common sense provision in the Constitution. But I just, it bothers me that an atheist or an agnostic who might have the same view about lying to parents, about even the metaphysical impossibility of so-called transitions and so-called transgender transition, or I guess it's in the name, so-called transgender, because the word trans means change, like transportation, change locations, transform, change forms. Is that even possible to change gender? And it seems to me that an atheist or agnostic might very well say no. And then they can kind of left out of the dark because they don't have sincerely well held religious beliefs. Now, one way you can go about this is you can say that atheism is a sincerely held religious belief. You could do that, I guess. Okay. But you see the problem, right? I mean, there is some precedent for that. If you look at Torcaso versus Watkins, 1961, footnote 11, you'll see that one of the types of religion that is mentioned is secular humanism, and one of the tenets of secular humanism is atheism. So you could go that route. I don't know how well the developed that is, though, but it's just, it bothers me. I'm just saying that it bothers me here. But let's keep going here. Now, their sincerity is in undisputed. The four teacher plaintiffs and class representatives sincerely hold religious beliefs that are being severely burdened by the imposition of the parental exclusion policies. Their sincerity is undisputed. Compelling teacher plaintiffs to observe the state's parental exclusion policies or leave their employment in any of the California Department of Education's local educational agencies and school districts works a substantial burden on the teacher plaintiff's First Amendment rights to free exercise. As the policies remain the same and the state defendants intend to continue enforcement of the policies in their local schools, the same legal analysis used for the preliminary injunction of Escondido Union School District's local policy applies here, which yields the same conclusion. The antithetical policies severely burden the free exercise rights of teachers with religious convictions. The policies are neither generally applicable nor narrowly tailored. I am going to read footnote 13, bottom page 45. Under the policies, informing parents about a student's gender incongruity without the consent of the student is deemed unlawful discrimination or harassment when administrators decide that the parent lacks a legitimate need for the information. Lacks a legitimate need for the information. There are no standards written in the policies for determining when a parent has a legitimate need of the information. only that it requires a case-by-case decision by administrators. This means, this is footnote 13, bottom page 45. This means whether disciplinary action is taken against a teacher who informs a parent depends on an undefined ad hoc determination. We're on page 46, continuing the footnote. This is the very definition of a discretionary exemption. Quote, a law is not generally applicable if it invites the government to consider the particular reasons for a person's conduct by providing a mechanism for individualized exemptions, unquote. Under the Fulton framework, a law is not generally applicable if it invites the government to consider the particular reasons for a person's conduct providing a mechanism for individualized exemptions. That's Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, 593 U.S. reports at 533, 2021, he's referring to. Now, the authority to find or not find that a parent has good enough need to know about their child's gender incongruity is retained by the state defendant's local agency administrators. The retention of this authority to decide when a teacher may properly inform a parent creates a not generally applicable policy. That, in turn, means it must satisfy strict constitutional scrutiny. Quote, this authority to decide which reasons for not complying with the policy are worthy of solicitude on an ad hoc basis renders the policy not generally applicable and requires the application of strict scrutiny, citing Fulton, 2021 at 687. Footnote 14, we're going to get to in a sec. Okay, going back up to page 45. The antithetical policies severely burden the free exercise rights of teachers with religious convictions. The policies are neither generally applicable nor narrowly tailored. The policies burden a great deal more than is necessary for any compelling interest of the state defendants have. It quote, if you're not able to follow this policy, you may have to find a different job, unquote, is not an example of a narrowly tailored infringement on a core federal constitutional right. Page 46 at the top. Let's take a look at footnote 14 here. The state defendants have no compelling interest in creating safe and inclusive campuses through deceiving parents. Well, that's really good. The state defendants have no compelling interest in creating a safe and inclusive in creating safe and inclusive campuses through deceiving parents about their children because there is a presumption that fit parents act in the best interests of their children. Moreover, that's a presumption. Moreover, the state defendants have no compelling interests in enforcing their parental exclusion policies against teachers to comply with California or federal law because their policies are not required by California or federal law, or if required by California law, must yield to federal constitutional law. Makes sense to me. Continuing footnote 14 at the bottom, page 46. While inclusiveness is a worthy pursuit, it does not justify uncertain exemptions or exemptions from the broad non-discrimination policies, which undermine their neutrality and general applicability and burden-free exercise. That's quoting Fellowship of Christian Athlete versus San Jose Unified School District. And that's the Ninth Circuit, 2023. In the 82nd volume of the fourth edition of the Federal Reporter, starting at 664, but quoting 687. There's another typo too. I just found another typo. It says Fellowship of Christian Athlete should say Christian Athletes. And you can see it, the S is up there on line 14, 15. By the way, the lines are not lining up again. They're lined up on line 7, and then by line 10, they're not lining up. Another thing that bothers me. But hey, let's continue. Page 46. The state defendants are aware that the free exercise burden on its teaching staff is widely felt. Quote, these statistics paint a clear picture, a religious exercise exemption that allows California school staff to disclose a student's gender identity without their consent will be utilized by thousands and thousands of employees, unquote. Although aware of the burden on free exercise rights, the state defendants offer no exemptions or other attempts at narrow tailoring. Instead, they say, in essence, narrow tailoring is too cumbersome. Page 47 at the top. However, this is a problem of the state defendants' own making. Amen, bro. Amen. Yeah. That's not something to complain about, California. You're the one that did it. It is not a defense justifying a broad-based trenching on individual rights. When the state drops an elephant in the middle of its classroom, it's not a defense to say the elephants are too heavy to move. Man. The school district defendant in Mahmoud made a similar argument that if it grants opt-outs from LGBTQ plus inclusive storybooks, it would be too cumbersome and unworkable because the number of absent students would be unsustainably high. Oh, man. Oh, that's a case we got to do on the podcast. The Mahmoud Court. There's another typo. Man, there's a lot of typos here. The Mahmoud is spelled wrong. MOH. It should be MAH. The Mahmoud Court brushed the argument away because the school's concern was self-inflicted. Justice Thomas explains, quote, the school board may not insulate itself from First Amendment liability by weaving religiously offensive material throughout its curriculum and thereby significantly increase the difficulty and complexity of remedying parents' constitutional injuries, unquote. Oh, man. In the end, under state defendants' parental exclusion policies, anti-discrimination laws, the subclass of religious teachers face an unlawful choice between sacrificing their faith and sacrificing their teaching position. The only meaningful justification for the state defendants, the state defendants offer for its policy's insistence that the plaintiffs not reveal to parents gender information about their own children, rests on a mistaken view that the state's public schools hold a duty to place a child's right to privacy above and in derogation of the rights of parents. This is the system that is taking tax money to supposedly edumacate your students, and they're Democrats. They're freaking Democrats, dude. As mentioned previously, the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution requires the opposite. Page 48 at the top. The teacher plaintiffs have proven the merits of their free exercise claim and are entitled, as a matter of law, to a declaration and permanent injunction. Line 5, letter D as in dog. Yes, it is D as in dog. Teachers' First Amendment free speech rights claim 1. Teachers' First Amendment free speech rights claim 1. The subclass of public school teachers also seek a declaration that the state privacy policies violate their First Amendment rights to free speech. The state defendants contend that teachers are hired to deliver government-approved curricular speech. Communicating with parents about student school progress is part of that speech for which they are hired. The plaintiff's argument that teachers may speak freely is that teachers may speak freely whatever is on their own mind on matters of curricular speech is foreclosed by Johnson versus Poway Unified School District, Ninth Circuit, 2011. That's in the 658th volume of the third edition of the Federal Reporter, starting at 954. There, the Ninth Circuit recognized that expression is a teacher's stock and trade, the commodity she sells to her employer in exchange for a salary. Certainly, Johnson did not act as a citizen when he went to school and taught class, took attendance, supervised students, or regulated their comings and goings. He acted as a teacher, a government employee, according to Johnson. Johnson concluded, all the speech of which Johnson complains belongs to the government, and the government has a right to speak for itself. When it does, it is entitled to say what it wishes and to select the views that it wants to express. Here, like Johnson, and when we're talking about Johnson, that is the case, Johnson versus Poway Unified School District. I almost said Poway Weapons and Gear. Sorry. Man. Poway Unified School District. You 2A people will like that. It's a gun store and shooting range in Poway. The PWG is, I have one of their pens laying around somewhere. Okay. So when he said, so here, like Johnson, and he's talking about this, the case, Johnson, the teacher plaintiffs are school government teachers, public school government teachers. Teaching, taking attendance, supervising students, regulating their comings and goings are activities that are part of their employee duties. Included among their duties as teachers is the duty to communicate with a student's parents from time to time about the student's school performance. It is difficult to say that their classroom speech during the school day as teachers is their own rather than the school district's. Consequently, at least where this teacher's compelled speech takes place during the school day on curricular matters, Johnson, that is that case from the Ninth Circuit 2011, Johnson forecloses a generic freedom of speech claim. But while this is generally true, Judge Mediatus says on the top of page 49, the drawing of lines in this case requires more nuance, requires a nuanced approach. The defense position is that everything a teacher speaks while on the job is subject to that which the government decides should be spoken. Jeez. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yet teachers retain, say that in a German accent, yet teachers retain at least some speech of their own inside the schoolhouse gate. After all, it has long been established that teachers and students have First Amendment rights. Consequently, the state defendants are correct that this current state of constitutional law holds that if the speech in question is part of an employee's official duties, the employer may insist that the employee deliver any lawful message. At the same time, the Supreme Court has said, however, it is not easy to imagine a situation in which a public employer has a legitimate need to demand that its employees recite words with which they disagree. That's citing Janus 585 US at 907. Makes sense to me. Yeah, I like this nuance. The case presented here lies somewhere between the two extremes. Judge Benitez continues on line 15. Page 49, Mirabelli versus Olson, 22 December 2025. The teacher plaintiffs have a direct disagreement with parental exclusion policy that they may not inform a parent, a student's parent, about the student's expressions of gender incongruity absent consent from the student. The problem is that when a parent asks directly, the teachers are compelled to avoid answering. Jeez. The problem is that when a parent asks directly, the teachers are compelled to avoid answering. Purposeful avoidance, or worse, purposeful deception by a teacher or staff member directly undermines a parent's 14th Amendment right to care for their child in every case and may undermine a religious parent's First Amendment right to direct their child's religious upbringing. Teachers successfully make out a First Amendment freedom of speech claim when they are compelled to speak in violation of the law or to deliberately convey an illegal message. In this case, because the state defendant's parental exclusion policies demand that teachers communicate misrepresentations or deceptively avoidant responses to parental questions, which in turn violate the constitutional rights of parents, this type of government speech may not be forced upon teachers who conscientiously disagree. Well, there you go. Okay, we got some help for the atheists and for the agnostics who have some common sense. Praise God. Page 50 at the top. Roman numeral 5, Article 3 standing. The state defendants assert that neither the parents nor the teachers enjoy Article 3 standing. This court disagrees, as it explained in its earlier order. In opposition to the motion for summary judgment, the state defendants re-urged the same arguments. However, the more recent arguments have been drained of any new vigor by virtue of the state defendants withdrawing their mootness claims. Man, Article 3 standing. You guys know what Article 3 standing is. Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution is the vesting clause that vests the judicial power in the Supreme Court and inferior courts that are set up by Congress. The power is limited to deciding cases and controversies that come before the court. So the court is not a little mini me junior varsity legislature that pronounces on things happening in the culture at whim without a case or controversy there. The court has nothing to do. But the question is, what counts as a case or controversy? And for there to be a case or controversy, the plaintiff has to have standing to bring an action. There has to be standing to bring it. And federally, that means from John versus Defender of Wildlife case is classically meant to mean that there's a concrete harm that is caused by the defendant and redressable by the court. Three things: concrete harm experienced by the plaintiffs, that is caused by the defendant and redressable by the court. Now, I don't know what it is in California as far as state law goes. I'm sure it resembles that. But federally, that's typically how it's cashed out. Now, it gets a little bit weird when you talk about the Establishment Clause but Article 3 standing doctrine is very interesting to get into. Generally, I would say that so for some of these constitutional rights, the standing, what counts as a harm gets a little bit squishy. Like, for example, when you walk by a Ten Commandments display and you're offended, or you might possibly be offended, does that count as a harm to provide the harm prong of that three prong requirement for standing to bring action? And I'm assuming that it's on government property and that it's a viewable on public property, the Ten Commandments example, or a Christmas tree, or a nativity scene. The nativity scenes are the classic example of some of these. See Wallace versus Jaffrey, 1985. But you know what? People have gone, or hearing a prayer at a graduation, like Lee versus Weissman, Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. That thing has been up and down the courts, I don't know how many times. We actually had Philip Vincent Munoz come on the podcast. Vincent Philip Munoz, excuse me, come on the podcast, teaches at Notre Dame Law School. And we had the same mentor, Michael Uhlman, by the way. One of the same mentors. I've got his books laying around, and I've taught from his books before. I'm going to link that in this episode here. Let's keep going. We're going to finish this. Okay, let's keep going. Mootness. The state defendants initially argued that parental exclusion policies had been withdrawn and were, by implication, no longer in effect. The state defendants now have withdrawn this argument in view of the California Department of Education's newly redistributed PRISM cultural competency training required of teachers and certificated staff in 7th through 12th grades, mandated by California Education Code Section 218.3, letter C. Well, there we go. And then there's the permanent injunction. Number seven, permanent injunction. According to well-established principles of equity, a plaintiff seeking a permanent injunction must satisfy a four-factor test before a court may grant such relief. A plaintiff must demonstrate, one, that it has suffered an irreparable injury, two, that remedies available at law, such as monetary damages, are inadequate to compensate for that injury, three, that considering the balance of hardships between the plaintiff and defendant, a remedy in equity is warranted, and four, that the public interest would not be disserviced by a permanent injunction. For elements three and four, when the government is a party, the balance of equities and public interest factors merge. Page 51 at the top. All four factors are satisfied in this case. The parent plaintiffs have succeeded on the merits of their motion for summary judgment of their on their substantive due process and free exercise claims, and therefore satisfy the four-factor test, entitling them to permanent injunctive relief on this claim. This is also true for the teacher plaintiffs in regard to their First Amendment free exercise and free speech claims. First, both the parents and teachers have established irreparable injury by showing the state defendants are violating their rights. The loss of First Amendment freedoms, even for a minimal period of time, unquestionably constitutes irreparable injury. Second, the only relief plaintiffs request is that is available against the state defendants and appropriate for these unconstitutional violations is injunctive relief. Third, the balance of hardships between the plaintiff class of parents and teachers versus the state defendants warrants injunctive relief. The First and 14th Amendment rights are core constitutional rights. The state's competing interests are less substantial and light in comparison and must yield. The fourth factor, the public interest, would not be disserviced by a permanent injunction. As noted above, this element merges with the third when the government is a party. Together, it is always in the public interest to prevent the violation of a party's constitutional rights. Roman numeral seven, conclusion. Parental involvement in essential, there's another typo. Parental involvement in essential should be is, IS, not IN. Parental involvement is essential to the healthy maturation of school children. California's public school system parental exclusion policies place a communication barrier between parents and teachers. Some parents do not want such barriers. Who do not want such barriers may have the wherewithal to place their children in private schools or homeschool or to move to a different public school district. Families in middle or lower socioeconomic circumstances have no such options. For these parents, the new policy appears to undermine their own constitutional rights while it conflicts with knowledgeable medical opinion. The state defendants are, in essence, asking this court to limit and restrict a common sense and legally sound description by the United States Supreme Court of parental rights that this court will not do, page 52 at the top. Although, as stated previously, the state's desire to protect vulnerable children from harassment and discrimination is laudable, the parental exclusion policies create a trifecta of harm. They harm the child who needs parental guidance and possibly mental health intervention to determine if the incongruence is organic or whether it is the result of bullying, peer pressure, or a fleeting impulse. They harm the parents by depriving them of the long-recognized 14th Amendment right to care, guide, make health decisions for their children. and by substantially burdening many parents' First Amendment rights to train their children in their sincerely held religious beliefs. Another typo. There's no period. There should be a period there. And finally, they harm teachers who are compelled to violate the sincerely held religious, excuse me, the sincerely held beliefs and the parent. Man, I'm screwing this up. Sorry. And finally, they harm teachers who are compelled to violate the sincerely held beliefs and the parents' rights by forcing them to conceal information they feel is critical for the welfare of their students. A permanent injunction against announcing, repeating, or enforcing the parental exclusion policies will issue in a separate order. Dated December 22nd, 2025, Roger T. Benitez, United States District Judge. And that's it. Thank God for Roger T. Benitez. Praise the Lord. Thank you, Lord, for this decision. We're now going to have a chaplain's corner. And we're going to get to today Psalm 15. And we're doing NIV today because I was reading the King James Version on my cigar time last night, and I left it in my cigar bag. So we're going to do the NIV today. Please don't judge me. Psalm 15, NIV. Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary, who may live on your holy hill. He whose walk is blameless and who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from his heart and has no slander on his tongue, and who does his neighbor no wrong and casts no slur on his fellow man, who despises a vile man but honors those who fear the Lord, who keeps his oath even when it hurts, who lends his money without usury and does not accept a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. Psalm 15. Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? He whose walk is blameless and who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from his heart and has no slander on his tongue, who does his neighbor no wrong and casts no slur on his fellow man, who despises a vile man but honors those who fear the Lord, who keeps his oath even when it hurts, who lends his money without usury and does not accept a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. Psalm 15, NIV, a moment of reflection. And now in our chaplain's corner, we have a moment of reflection on Streams in the Desert, February 2nd. We've been doing this since Charlie Kirk was murdered that same week. Okay. In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me and made me a polished shaft. In his quigger, sorry. In his quiver hath he hid me. Isaiah 49:2. In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me and made me a polished shaft. In his quiver Hath he hid me? Isaiah 49:2. This is good. This is good stuff. I think it's good stuff. One moment. Okay. Streams in the Desert, February 2nd. In the Shadow. We must all go there sometimes. The glare of the daylight is too brilliant. Our eyes become injured and unable to discern the delicate shades of color or appreciate neutral tints, the shadowed chamber of sickness, the shadowed house of mourning, the shadowed life from which the sunlight has gone. But fear not, it is the shadow of God's hand. He is leading thee. There are lessons that can be learned only there. The photograph of his face can only be fixed in the dark chamber, but do not suppose that he has cast thee aside. Thou art still in his quiver. He has not flung thee away as a worthless thing. He is only keeping thee close till the moment comes when he can send thee most swiftly and surely on some errand in which he will be glorified. Oh, shadowed solitary ones, remember how closely the quiver is bound to the warrior, within easy reach of the hand and guarded jealously. In some spheres, the shadow condition is the condition of greatest growth. The beautiful Indian corn never grows more rapidly than in the shadow of a warm summer night. The sun curls the leaves in the sultry noon light, but they quickly unfold if a cloud slips over the sky. There is a service in the shadow that is not in the shine. The world of stellar beauty is never seen at its best till the shadows of night slip over the sky. There are beauties that bloom in the shade that will not bloom in the sun. There is much greenery in lands of fog and clouds and shadow. The florist has evening glories now, as well as morning glories. The evening glory will not shine in the noon splendor, but it comes to its best as the shadows of evening deepen. If all of life were sunshine, our faces would be fain to feel once more upon them the cooling plash of rain. Henry Van Dyke was the author of that poem. Page 38 at the top. Streams in the Desert, February 2nd. A moment of reflection. Well, thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Today is Wednesday, 22 July 2026, years after Jesus. Like I said, it's a Wednesday. Take care. God bless you guys. Thank God for Roger Benitez and Republican judges. They're not all great, but the great ones are the best.